and welcome to the Locust Roundtable podcast. For this installation, we are talking to Brett Cox, who's calling in from New Hampshire, I believe.
Vermont.
Oh, and as a New Englander, I should have my New England states down better than that. My apologies. And also Andy Duncan, calling in from, I believe, the campus that he works on in Frostburg, Maryland.
The English Department Computer Lab at Frostburg State University, yes, indeed.
To whom we are greatly indebted, I see.
That's right. Got to put in a plug.
I, on the other hand, am calling from my extraordinarily cluttered office in our home in Vermont. Although I should say that I am using a laptop that was issued to me from my university, which is Norwich University in Northfield, Vermont. So Andy and I are both indebted to our employers.
Excellent.
Yep, yeah.
Employment. And who I'm sure appreciate the free advertising.
Well, they might.
So one thing I thought we might talk about a little bit this evening, I know both of you have done some awards judging in the past, and that's a process that's pretty opaque to those of us who haven't done it yet. Of course, their whole, Cheryl Morgan would chime in at this point and let everyone know that there are many different kinds of awards. Some are popularly voted, some are juried, and the ones that we'd be talking about are when you guys have sat on awards juries.
Right.
And so, Brett, could you talk a little bit about some of the awards you've been involved in?
Sure. Well, the main thing I've been involved with in the past few years has been the Shirley Jackson Awards. I was one of the, we've been using the phrase founding jurors, which means that the group of us who got the awards started initially served as jurors for the first couple of years, but that has completely rotated now, and now that we're into the fourth year of the award, we've got a separate set of jurors, and now those of us who were in at the beginning are constituted as the board of directors for the award. So, and in fact, Andy has just finished a stint serving on the Shirley Jackson Awards jury, and he can talk about that, I guess. But I've served with the Shirley Jackson Awards. I've been on the Bram Stoker Awards Editions jury, which is something a little bit different. That's constituted to add things to categories that, in addition to the works that make it onto the ballot based on the recommendations and votes of the members of the Horror Writers Association. And I've also served on the jury for the SFRA Pilgrim Award, which is the Lifetime Achievement Award given for a lifetime contributions to science fiction scholarship by the Science Fiction Research Association. So that's my jury back.
Okay, and Andy?
I'm just thinking. I was on the Stoker Editions jury for 3 years ago under a different configuration than the one Brett has served under, I believe.
Pretty much the same, though, because we were on at different times, but it was the same thing. It's just been this year that they have changed everything around in a way that I'm still not sure I can navigate properly. Although I'm involved with that, too. I'm also on now they've got the juries for different juries for individual categories, and I'm serving on the short fiction jury for this year.
Right, in my 3 years on the editions jury, as I recall, there was a single jury to make an edition in each category, I believe.
Right, and that's what I did, only it was 3 different years.
So I did it for 3 years, and I was chair the final year, the third year. And as Brett says, I just finished being on the Shirley Jackson Awards jury, the most recent jury, the one impaneled to decide the ballot and the winners to be announced at ReaderCon this summer. And just before that, I was chair of the Philip K. Dick Award jury that was impaneled to pick the finalists and pick the winners for the award ceremony held in April is it Norwestern where that happens? I beg your pardon.
I think so.
Not quite remembering. I know it's the Philip K. Dick Trust, the Philadelphia Science Fiction Society, and I believe NorwestCon, the three sponsoring organizations. I believe it's NorwestCon where it happens. So that's my awards experience in the field to date. Although, as I think I said on the Locus Online blog a few weeks ago, it's really not that much different from the various scholarship committees I've been on. Any committee where you're sitting discussing with other people the haves and the have-nots, who's in and who's out, who your short list is, it's really not unlike the process of when Brett and I were putting the Crossroads and fiction anthology together years ago, of which stories to include, which stories not, and that sort of thing. It's human nature, this sort of parsing of hard to parse definition of indefinable qualities that juries do.
And for that matter, it's not unlike being on a job search committee, which is something that both of us have done, or at least I've done in my capacity as an academic. Andy, I don't know if you've been on any job search committee.
I haven't yet, but that train is coming.
your foot shall slide in due time.
I recruited for one this summer and banged off, but that will come again.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, it's an odd thing because you were really trying. I think that it's my experience that people on juries are really trying to do their best and come to the best decisions that they can. And I think that we're also aware, or at least I try to be aware, of the fact that these decisions have consequences. I think that even if there isn't a commercial impact from an award, and I don't know enough to be able to say which awards do have such an impact and which awards don't. I've heard all sorts of discussions about the Hugo does this, the Nebula does that, and so forth. But they certainly have an impact on the people who win them. They have, I think that they have an impact on readers, because this is something I think that came out in the Locus blog. How many people will adjust their reading to the news that something has won the award? You know, how many people will say, oh, that won a Shirley Jackson Award, or that won the Philip K. Dick Award? Well, I like Shirley Jackson. I like Philip K. Dick. I think I'll read that.
I know this is a perennial topic among booksellers, to what extent these things really do drive sales. But anecdotally, I've heard from so many people who do say they are more inclined to pick up a book, or particularly a piece of short fiction, if it has been somehow shortlisted and recognized by someone. Now, with short fiction, there are now so many, thank goodness, blogs and websites devoted to them, particularly in our field, reviews of them, that those reviewers serve some of the purpose that the short lists of awards traditionally provided. But I think they're still perhaps most valuable as reading lists and as long-term reading lists, so that you can see where the field was at a given time with its tastes, with its preferences and interests, the same way a shelf full of Dozois' Year's Best anthologies give you a sense of where the field was in any given year.
And if you get it early enough in your reading of the field, and it can have a tremendous impact. I know that when I was reading as a young man many, many years ago, and was just getting started with science fiction, that one of my gateway experiences
was those Isaac Asimov Hugo Winners anthologies, and also the annual volumes of the Nebula Winners, which all of which were available through my local library. And that's absolutely a case of an award helping to shape somebody's perceptions. I don't know if it shaped my tastes necessarily, but it certainly shaped my perceptions of what the field was and what people considered good.
That was certainly true for me of those three science fiction Hall of Fame volumes.
Right.
That Silverberg and Bova edited in the early 70s.
Which were intended to be kind of retroactive nebulas.
That's right. It's basically like a retro nebula. They poll everybody at CIFLA at the time to pick their favorite stories published before the nebulas were created. And that's how they came up with those. So that was basically a set of award winners.
Right.
Just being gifted with hindsight so that they could vote for Karn Bluth's The Little Black Bag and they could vote for
Flowers for Algernon.
Right, Daniel Keyes and H.G. Wells and so forth.
Yeah, Fondly Fahrenheit, Coming Attraction.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm actually I'm reading my way through those three volumes right now. So yes. People are still picking them up and reading them.
It is. They are not perfect selections, Lord knows. But there's a lot of the field's history there, and a lot of the field's love and attention.
And actually, one of the I think it's worth noting that one of the most useful critical books that we have is a direct result of that first anthology, the Robert Silverberg Science Fiction Hall of Fame Volume 1, and that's that book Rationalizing Genius John Huntington, is that his name?
I believe that's his name.
Yeah, and I apologize to Professor Huntington if we're misremembering his name, but that book uses the Silverberg anthology as a basis for talking about the science fiction short story, and he does a wonderful job going through those stories and showing just exactly what they seem to be representing about science fiction. It's a marvelous book. I don't know if it's still in print, but I certainly would recommend it to anyone who's seriously interested in the study of science fiction.
It is a marvelous book, and it has informed a lot of how I read not only the older material, but the current material, too. But to get back to our original point, I mean, here again, you poll people, you get a set of votes. Based on those votes, you come up with a short list of titles out of all the many, many, many titles out there. And it's necessarily imperfect, but it also gives you a snapshot of where the field is at a given moment and what its preoccupations are and what the tastes of the voters are, whether those be 300 voters, as in the case of the Nebulas, or a handful of voters in the case of a juried award like the Shirley Jackson.
Right, and it also is worth noting, and I don't know that I've ever seen this really commented on, and I think it's worth commenting on, that with these juried awards, it's, except for the Sturgeon Award, as I understand it, and I'm willing to be corrected on that, but whether it's the Shirley Jackson Award or the World Fantasy Award, you have a different set of jurors each year. And so you've got this constantly revolving assembly of tastes and concerns that come to it. So that is something that needs to be factored into how you consider the awards as well. And as for what Andy was saying about assembling the short list, of course, the big issue with awards juries is coverage. I think, how do you read everything? Well, the answer is you don't. You can't. There just isn't any way to do that. You simply have to make a good faith effort to read as much and as widely as you can. And heaven knows,
and Andy and I and anybody who's ever been on one of these juries experiences this, you do get a lot of stuff in the mail. You really do. You get a lot of stuff in the mail. So, and you go through it to the best of your ability.
And increasingly, you also get a lot of it emailed to you now.
That's right.
Downloadable PDFs and so mm-hmm. forth.
I've become far more accustomed to reading long stretches of text on a computer screen than I ever thought I would, simply because of all the stuff that comes in PDF files.
And what are the discussions, when there is a discussion among jurors, one of the discussions always becomes a comparison of what the shape of your reading is. Because some people will do everything they can to limit their reading to the established genre markets. What's going on at Asimov's and Tor.com and Strange Horizons and so forth. And then there are other people who will be just as determined not to read everything but that stuff, but certainly to read as far afield as they can so they can drag stuff in and say, look, this counts too. This should be considered as well. Ideally, your resulting list will be the result of a conversation among people. But I know that one of the occasional frustrations of this is when your lens that you're applying to the material is rather different from your fellow jurors' lenses, and the one group just cannot persuade the other to readjust that lens. And so what can you do? I mean, that's just part of the nature of the enterprise.
That's right. And some of it depends on the impetus of the award itself. I know with the Shirley Jackson Awards, for my part, and I'm just speaking for myself here, I strongly favored and have always strongly favored reading as widely as possible across different sources. And one of my most pleased moments in my involvement in the awards was either last year or year before, I can't remember which, when in the category for the finalists for best short story, there was a story from Cemetery Dance magazine, which is a very well-established core genre horror magazine, and there was also a story from The New Yorker. And in my vision of things, that's how it should be. But as Andy pointed out, everybody doesn't share my vision, alas. So
I was thinking of that, and I guess years have passed and nobody much cares anymore, but I was on the Stoker one year, Stoker Editions jury, and I was really trying to talk up Octavia Butler's Fledgling, her last novel, as a novel edition that year. And I could not convince a quorum of my fellow jurors that Fledgling was A, a horror novel, and that Octavia Butler was B, a horror author. And I argue for the same reasons that Brett is just saying, that just read the book. Just read the book. It's a vampire novel, if you want to apply that lens to it. It's about a lot of other things, too. But I just couldn't make the headway. That was in somebody else's genre, as far as my fellow jurors were concerned.
Well, that I have these, since years have also passed since I was on the Stoker jury, I'll go ahead and say that my version of that was the first year I was on the jury was the year that Cormac McCarthy's novel The Road came out, and I jumped up and down about this book to the jurors, and for a variety of differing reasons, they just weren't having it. So, again, you know, what are you going to do? I think that and that's a novel, I think, functions as a science fiction novel and as a horror novel. And although this wasn't said, I do wonder, with books like that, whether it's Cormac McCarthy or anyone, you know, pick the crossover artist of your choice, I think sometimes there's a sense of, well, they're not going to care, they're not going to appreciate what we're trying to do by honoring their work, to which I respond, I don't care. You know, I'm sure Cormac McCarthy would be utterly indifferent, if not hostile, to the idea of The Road being given a Bram Stoker Award, and, you know, I don't care. That I'm not interested in that. I mean, the question is whether or not the book is worthy of consideration. And so, yeah, there are those sorts of things that we have to deal with sometimes as well. And you also have to, when you're on a jury, you have to just accept the fact that you are not going to get your way on everything.
It's got to be a consensus.
It has to be a consensus.
And often, if you have six people say, maybe everyone has a different number one pick. And you wind up with like six number one votes, and everybody has their own horse in that race, but everybody agrees on their number two pick. It would not be unusual for that number two pick to wind up as the award winner that year, because they couldn't get any consensus on, all right, if not this one, then which one do we like better? And there's no consensus on that, but everybody can... there is consensus that this particular title is liked by everyone equally.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes that's what it comes down to. And again, it depends on the award. Just what I have heard in passing informally from people who have been on other awards juries, I mean, every individual jury will have a different personality, and every award is set up, I think, with a different sort of impetus. I'm sure that there are some juries where the whole thing comes down to back and forth chatting and arguing and compromise and eventual consensus, and there are some juries that may be just more by the numbers, people voting, and more like if it was it would be on a public awards ballot. So it all depends. That's one of the most unsatisfying sentences that can be uttered in English, but it's unfortunately true. It all depends.
And the major awards like Hugo's and Nebula's have done this admirable effort through the years to make the process as numerical as possible. Charles Brown, rest his soul, always loved the annual breakdowns of the Hugo voting in Locust. And I always pore over those myself. It's fascinating, even if it's depressing, to see yourself on the ballot and see how, using the Australian ballot rules, you were eliminated on the first round of voting, and so on and so forth. But that is an effort to... make transparent, just the same way the reporting of, say, presidential elections and senatorial elections, so you can actually see who voted for what, and in the case of the Hugo, when, you know, how many first place votes this got on the first round, and so on and so forth. Just today, some friends of mine in the science fiction and fantasy writers of America were grumbling darkly to me about the Nebula Award system. And that said,
Sifwa was complaining?
Amazing. And so I logged on to the site and was reading all the discussion about maybe we should do it this way and maybe we should do it that way. And I just laughed. I said, This is where I came in when I joined CIFLA more than a decade ago. It was the same conversation.
Oh, and it's going to be the same conversation 50 years from now, if there are still nebulas 50 years from now, people are always going to be arguing about this. But two things that popped to mind. One, when Andy was talking about seeing the breakdown of the votes, one of the things, if you take a careful look at that, it really does make you realize, with something like the Hugo or the Nebula or the Locus Awards, that every vote does count.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what it must be like to see that your work failed to make the final ballot by just a handful of votes, which is often the case if you look at those things, because we're generously informed of the works that don't quite make the ballot.
There are always works that miss by one vote making the ballot.
Sure. One of the most interesting things that came out of that Locus blog discussion was whoever it was. Andy, was it you? I can't remember. Somebody posted a list of all of these really good, well-known writers who have never won a Hugo or a Nebula.
And I did it, but it is true.
Yeah, Gary had picked some of that off what Mark Kelly compiles for the Locus Index to Awards.
Right, right. And when you consider that the likes of, who was it, you know, Tim Powers and people of that caliber have not found their way onto these award ballots, it does give you pause. But the other thing I was going to say, to get back to the issue of just the sheer volume of reading, and this is something that I think everybody who's been on an awards jury has experienced, which is simply that you come to a real appreciation for work that is really good because you are witness to so much work that is not. I think I'll just leave it at that. But it is stunning. The things that will come in the mail that somebody thinks should be considered for an award.
Well, I don't know if for your anthology that you guys had to do much slush reading?
We didn't really, because it was an invitation-only anthology.
It was not.
Now, we certainly did not accept everything that was sent to us, and that was made clear to people at the beginning, but it was not an open call for submissions. We just sent out invitations to people we thought should be in.
It's just that your comment about reading through so much for awards juries, I spent a year roughly reading slush for Strange Horizons, and I learned so much about story by watching stories go wrong.
Right. Exactly.
Great experience.
It is.
It's invaluable.
Phenomenal. And the other thing was that, exactly. It makes you appreciate the gems so much more. They really stand out in contrast.
Oh, absolutely. I think everybody who's serious about writing should have the opportunity to read slush. The opportunity of a lifetime.
And I hear that Strange Horizons is still looking for slush readers, so everybody go sign up.
Yes, other people.
Other people.
I've done my time. I did read slush briefly for the first couple of stories I ever had published were in ahead of its time small press magazine called Forbidden Lines that was published out of Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And if you are interested in the history of these things, Nathan Ballingrud also had an early story in Forbidden Lines. So go dig all of that up and sell it on eBay. But I did read slush for a while for that magazine, and oh man, it was a pretty numbing experience.
On the other hand, one thing I did notice, not being a writer myself, I noticed I had a slightly different reaction to it. A lot of the people who are writers themselves and read through the slush pile, you know, say to themselves, oh my gosh, I can do so much better than this. And sometimes that's followed with, why haven't I gotten published yet? Myself not being a writer, I have to admit, even the stories that were failing on whatever level, I absolutely went, no matter how flawed this is, you guys are doing something that I honestly couldn't do. I was just amazed by the seemingly infinite diversity and creativity and imagination that people had to throw at all these stories. I mean, every story was unique, and sometimes you get into a pattern of things repetitively, but mostly you go, wow, I never would have thought of that.
Well, sometimes the story you reject is the one that really sticks in your head that you still remember a few months later.
Yeah.
And not necessarily because it was so bad, but just because it had its own unique energy and its own strange angle that it came at the topic with, or its own unique voice or something. Those are the ones that should get the personal rejection.
right.
And that carries over even to the stuff that gets published. I mean, look at the discussions in your short story roundtable about these things. Go ahead, just look at them. there are stories, even stories that get nominated for and win awards, can often provoke, shall we say, diverse opinion. and one could argue that is in and of itself a source of strength.
SPITE is a very time-honored way of getting people into the business. I mean, there was Lester Del Rey that told the story about reading some Manly Wade Wellman story in some pulp magazine that just so annoyed him that he said, well, I can do better than that, and sat down and wrote his own story and sent it in and sold it. And that was the start of his professional writing career.
I think Spider Robinson said pretty much the same thing, that he read some story in some science fiction magazine and was so appalled by it that he said, I can write better than this, and so he could. But what you were saying, Karen, I think is true, because writing is an intensely brave act, and it is something that requires a lot of nerve to do. And even if it is a bad story, there one could make the argument that there is something heroic about just attempting that, just starting it and seeing it through to the end and finishing it. Now, one might not make that argument if one has read through 500 really awful stories in the past month, but I think your point's well taken.
Michael Martone, one of my mentors at the University of Alabama when I was in the MFA program there, likes to give his fiction classes the assignment the first week of write a bad story or a really bad scene and bring it in. We'll discuss it. And one of the points being, it's very interesting to see how there's very little disagreement on what constitutes badness. But there's also, it's very hard to write something bad from beginning to end that has no redeeming value, nothing of interest. So inevitably, you sit around the first week reading these things and people start saying, well, you know, I actually like this one. I actually thought this was funny, or I actually thought this is a good character, or that's a great opening paragraph, and so. So everything had something salvageable in it. And Michael used that to say, okay, now we've just got our palates cleansed. We don't have to worry about our panic of handing in something, quote, bad, end quote. We've got that out of our system.
It's hard to write something bad deliberately. In fact, I'll put in a plug for the other half of our writing household here. My wife, Jeannie Beckwith, is a playwright, and she started in on some sort of writing challenge or contest or something, and it was to write a really bad one-act play, and she started off doing this but then got caught up in it, and it turned out to be one of her more successful 10-act plays. In fact, Andy, it was The Last Detective, the one that some folks did at ICFA a couple of years ago. So it's very hard to write bad deliberately. But I think that also to get
but I think that it, to return to what I was saying earlier, that the issue of what a story provoking comment, whether it's good or bad, being a source of strength. I remember that I've had this in experience in writing workshops where my fear is not that somebody will say something bad about my story, because God knows somebody always does. But my fear is that they will say nothing about my story, that they won't find anything in it that's worthy of comment.
That's true. You want people to love you, but failing that, you just want them to pay attention somehow.
Right.
You don't want to be disregarded.
Yes.
And John Castle is fond of saying that if somebody really intensely dislikes a work, that on some intellectual level is only a couple of degrees away from really liking it.
Oh, sure.
It's a sort of compliment, because there's something there that means the text cannot be disregarded.
Right.
Just last night, my wife had already seen it, but we had Netflixed Black Swan.
Oh, we just watched that recently.
Yeah, the Darren Aronofsky ballet horror movie. I didn't know there were any ballet horror movies until I saw this.
There is now.
Maybe a genre of one with Natalie Portman, who gives a fierce and amazing performance. She deserved her Oscar. Speaking of awards.
Oh, yes.
But here's the but. I just watched much of the movie with my mouth open, just sort of appalled. And it really disturbed me more than merely tacky movies normally do. And it may be as simple as Sydney pointed out earlier today. It may just be as simple as all the self-mutilation theme just squicking me. But there's also something else going on there. I really, as I was watching it, was thinking about Hitchcock movies like Vertigo and The Birds, which are intentionally disturbing and are disturbing in ways that the filmmaker was not necessarily in control of, certainly not in The Birds. But here I thought, well, this is like the id sort of rampaging around. But also on another level, I thought, I'm not sure ballet is the chamber of horrors this makes it out to be.
I don't know about that. I mean, I know nothing about ballet, but I certainly know that you've got an art form where you have a limited... What other art form besides dance do you have a limited amount of time in which you can do it? All right? What other art form can you not do when you're old? That just suddenly popped in my head. But I think that's part of it, is that there's a statute of limitations on, you know, how long you can be a successful dancer. But it's interesting you should say that, Andy, because I watched that movie with my wife and... My oldest stepdaughter, and they both responded to it even more viscerally than I did because of the mother-daughter theme. Right? I mean, I think that was something that came out very strongly for them. But I didn't respond to it quite as viscerally, or I didn't find it disturbing. But then I have a pretty high tolerance for extremity of presentation in a film.
On the Shirley Jackson and Bram Stoker awards juries, I would hope so.
I guess so. Well, of course, when the extremity presentation is all that's going on, I'm sorry, I won't get distracted on that. but anyway, there's a quote that I saw attributed to Jean-Luc Godard. I don't know if he said it, but I hope he did. When somebody was critiquing the extreme level of violence in one of his movies, he said, "That's not blood, that's red." And I think I am able to bring that to certain movies. And Black Swan was an amazing thing. I don't begrudge Natalie Portman her Oscar, although I'm very sorry that it was in the same year as Jennifer Lawrence's performance in Winter's Bone, which really blew me away. That whole movie was just extraordinary.
Well, I bring up Brack's Black Swan because I've been thinking about since about Kessel's comment, and I think it is a tribute to what the filmmakers wrought that it did get under my skin some. To a point that I, who make my living articulating my responses to various texts, was rendered almost incoherent by this one. Yeah. And if we get back to our slush pile sort of topic, you know, if a story that did all those things or a novel that did all those things came into my slush pile and I had this very deep-rooted negative response to it, I think if I were really on my game, I would try to put it aside and come back to it later and look at it with some objectivity and think, well, you know, clearly I'm not responding to it with indifference. Clearly there is something there. And is it something that can be tweaked or channeled, or is it something that should not be tampered with? Maybe it's something that is its own unique thing that deserves to find an audience or start a conversation.
Yeah, this is getting a little bit away from the topic, whatever the topic was.
We don't have defined topics.
We don't, at this point, perhaps not. But what Andy's saying makes me think about a figure like H.P. Lovecraft, somebody who is, as I think by most people's standards, a deeply flawed artist on a number of levels, and yet, you know, gets under people's skin. Because what Andy was saying about Black Swan is sort of makes me think of my response to Lovecraft, whom I did not come to as a young reader, interestingly. Lovecraft was always kind of a blank spot for me. Then I moved to New England, and then suddenly it started making a lot more sense when I started reading Lovecraft's works. But just that explosive weirdness, you know, just that level of energy, and that's a word that I think is sometimes undervalued or underused in any kind of evaluation of art or literature, is energy. You know, Black Swan has energy in spades. It really does. And that's why I think it is capable of getting under people's skin, like Lovecraft got under people's skin, like Philip K. Dick got under people's skin.
You know, Brett, that's a really good point. The author who's very much like that for me is A.E. Van Vogt.
Oh, yes.
And again,
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
It's so easy to point out the flaws.
Yeah, I mean, as David Icke demonstrated, yeah.
Right.
Absolutely, but there's something there. And again, they're not stories I necessarily like, but they're stories that certainly have stuck with me in the years since I've read them. And I think that core quality of energy, that's a good way of thinking about it.
Yeah, and it's interesting you should mention Van Vogt, who was another blank spot for me. I mean, I grew up reading the usual stuff. When I was a kid, I had a classic science fiction conversion experience of starting and reading all this stuff that my older brother was so fond of, and which meant Heinlein and Clark and Asimov and Bradbury and all of those. But even when I was 12 and 13 years old, and I remember trying to read, I think it was The Weapon Shops of Isher, and my 13-year-old self thought, well, this is just whack. You know, this doesn't make any sense. You know, this isn't Isaac Asimov. It doesn't quite add up. But then when I read Van Vogt as an older reader, I was getting that sense of energy through this, you know, preposterous prose. And all the stuff that Damon and I talked about is true enough, and yet, you know, it really doesn't matter, does it?
that weird
energy is always there.
David Hartwell is fond of saying that no one can claim to understand science fiction or to have grasped science fiction unless they deal with the Van Vogt problem.
I remember Charles told me that too when I first started.
He's right. And you could substitute some other writers in there, but the comparison of Van Vogt and say Asimov or Damon Knight. I mean, Knight was a far better prose writer than Asimov was, as I think Asimov would probably freely admit. But both Asimov and Knight, you get the sense that here are these two happy craftsmen thinking of ideas and then trying to put them across as well as they can. But Van Vogt, like Lovecraft, like some other people you could name, you don't get this sense of that sense of objectivity. this is stuff that is written because it has to be written. It has to come out somehow. And there it all is. And it has that energy, that single-mindedness. What did somebody say of Harlan Ellison's stories? That the best of them, it's like the author is leaping out of the book to grab you by the collar and shake you and spit in your face and,
yeah.
and like bang your head against the wall and shout at you, you know, what he's trying to say. That is really intoxicating.
Yeah, somebody said something roughly similar about Robert Browning once. I still haven't figured that one out.
Though that makes sense if you read.
Yeah, that makes sense. What was it?
Dante Gabriel Rossetti or somebody.
Oh, yes.
Banner, Victorians.
Yeah, and but this also makes me think of something that the writer and critic John Gardner said. And although Gardner had his issues, to say the least, that when he was taught writing in. I don't know if it was on moral fiction or the art of fiction, but he said, and this is something I always give my students, I put it as a quote on the syllabus, that Gardner said that fiction should be a vivid and continuous dream. All right, a vivid and continuous dream. And what we're talking about with Van Vogt and Lovecraft and all these people is that they've got the vivid down. I mean, when I went back and read The Weapon Shop as an adult, I was struck with just how trippy this thing is, how utterly hallucinatory it is in a way that Asimov certainly never was. And so he's got the vivid thing down, but what the more sophisticated reader will struggle with is the issue of continuity, because you will come across some line or something that is so clunky that it's just going to toss you right out of it. But I guess that's the beauty of coming to it at a certain age, is that maybe you don't care about it.
But the amazing thing is when you encounter that berserk, unique slant on the world and that energy, the necessity of putting it across, coupled with the sort of intellectual agenda to have this all add up and make sense.
Right.
And there I'm thinking of somebody like Kelly Link, our contemporary.
Right.
When you're reading a story like the Hortlach about the all-night convenience store perched on the edge of the chasm where the zombies live, and the young woman that works at the animal shelter whose car is full of the ghosts of dogs that she's had to put down, and the narrator's coworker may or may not be ex-CIA and may or may not be wearing these special pajamas with messages on them, and so on and so forth. And it is quite as nuts as anything that Van Vogt or Lovecraft came up with, but it makes sense. The more you read it, the more sense it makes.
Oh yeah,
I read something like that, and I just want to follow Kelly Link around the rest of my life, which I suppose I am doing in some sense.
No, you're not.
I'm in the field with her anyway.
Well, that's
what
true.
She's doing.
Well, Andy and I have both been in workshops with Kelly Link, and it does. Yeah, it's got to make sense. It absolutely has to make sense. But Kelly's a good example of being able to marry the vividness and the continuity, because heaven knows, I think it's awfully hard to get thrown out of a Kelly Link story because of an awkward phrasing
or
felicitous characterization. And, of course, that's why we all revere Tiptree. right?
Yes.
That's why we revere Alice Sheldon. That's why some of us revere R.A. Lafferty. Or Cord Wainer Smith, these people who have that level of conceptual audacity, but have the writerly chops to bring it off and have it be, have it make sense. And it may be whack, but it's also elegant.
Carol M. Schwiller or Alfred Bester.
Carol M. Schwiller, certainly. And Alfred Bester, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you were talking, we were talking earlier about that first volume of the Science Fiction Hall of Fame and how some of the choices may be a bit odd. And it is interesting to go back in that book and try to see what holds up and what doesn't. But Bester's story in there, Fondly Fahrenheit, I mean, heavens, that just robs, you know, from start to finish.
That's a masterpiece, yeah.
Yeah, and Fritz Leiber's Coming Attraction, too. I mean, what, on some levels, Coming Attraction could have been written last week.
You know? Oh, yeah.
It's an amazing story.
Well, and A.J. Budry's Rogue Moon, the novella version of it, is also in the second volume, one of the Bova edited ones.
Right,
yeah.
Ooh, that, you know, I just read that a few weeks ago, and I was like, oh, wow.
Well, Budry's is one of those where you look at it and you say, yes, it can be done, and it can be done well. And now that you mention it, you know, I'm not sure I have ever read the novella version of Rogue Moon, because I read the novel, but that was an expansion of the novella, if I'm remembering. I don't think it was just the novella published as a standalone work.
I think I've read only the novella.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know what the difference is. I meant to ask Gary one of these days. So
between the two of us, we lick the platter clean.
I don't know if that's one of those that got expanded for the book version the way Flower Algernon did, or if it's simply one of those that showed up in separate cover later.
It could be. It's not a very long novel, I remember it. But again, it's just this beautifully done piece of. And of course, expanding things is not always a good idea.
Sometimes
better as other things. My favorite example of that is actually Roger Zelazny's novella "He Who Shapes" that was expanded into the Dream Master. Right. And the novel, the Dream Master, is a fine novel, but that original novella is just, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. It is utterly successful and really doesn't need any. But then again, I'm also the opinion that, no, there's no reason for any contemporary novel to be longer than 300 pages. This is a projection of my own anxieties.
Sure would be easier to be a reviewer in that universe.
Yes, it certainly would. It would be easier to be a jury member in that universe. But again, that's just a projection of my own anxieties, struggling with trying to write a novel. And sitting there as a short story writer thinking, isn't this done yet? How much longer do I have?
Somebody started a journal, and I can't remember the details, but they started an academic journal where all the articles are going to be about 300 words long. And it's a peer-reviewed journal. And if you're a peer reviewer for this journal, all they want from you is a yes or a no. So everything that gets like three yeses, they'll put in.
Oh, well, that
so
makes
it's sense. all very streamlined.
That's like a CEO who demands that everybody at a board meeting remain standing through the entire meeting.
Right, exactly. Or the Hollywood executive who makes everything fit on a card.
Right. MTV cops.
Right.
No, it's just, I don't know, you know, do you maybe, when we were talking earlier about, well, Karen, you just mentioned, in fact, the issue of book reviewing, and going back to what you were saying about feeling a certain level of admiration for even the bad stories that you read as a slush pile reader. I think that's one thing that sometimes people who write book reviews, and I've written my share of book reviews, I won't say they don't admit it, but maybe it's not overly discussed, is the fact that if you do write fiction, you know how hard it is. You know how much work somebody has put into this thing that you're trying to read. And it's, you know, you don't want to let anybody off, all right? You don't want to give somebody a pass if you think that they have done a bad job, but you can't help or I can't help but think, yeah, I know, I have some sense of what this person to produce this. And I can't help wondering if that informs, you know, people who are themselves fiction writers, as opposed to people who are solely
Yeah, I try to always keep in mind that for any short story, any novel, anything I read, I mean, that person has absolutely done something that I will never be able to do. People ask me sometimes, oh, well, if you're a writer, you know, when are you going to write fiction? And I'm like, why would I stop doing something I'm halfway decent at to go do something I would be horrible at?
Well, you've already invoked David Hartwell, but that's something I've heard him say, that he, when people ask him why he doesn't try writing fiction, and I heard him say in an interview once that he did try it and it was okay, but, you know, he feels much more that his calling is much more as an editor. And that what I was saying is that I've sometimes wondered about this use of the word writer to refer solely to people who write fiction, because I feel like I'm just as much a writer if I'm writing a critical essay or a book review as I am if I'm writing a short story.
Well, and the best, some of the best critics and reviewers can write almost at that level. You know, I love reading Liz Hand's criticism.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Samuel Delaney, oh my lord. Yeah. And even people who aren't fiction writers in their other lives, James Wood, or James Woods.
Right. James Woods, and, well, also the late Joanna Russ.
Yeah,
very much so.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's somebody, I was glancing through the Locust that just arrived and looking at the Russ obit. But there's a figure fully as influential as a fiction writer and as a critic.
Mm-hmm.
And the one is indistinguishable from the other, because when she was writing fiction, she was writing criticism. And when she was writing the criticism, she was advancing the cause of the fiction too.
And so, I often wonder if people within the field realize the level of influence that she had outside the field. I mean, I read her book How to Suppress Women Writers in a graduate level class on criticism and critical theory. That book was just tremendously influential to all sorts of people who really didn't know anything about her standing as a fiction writer.
Well, everybody I met in grad school knew Russ or knew of Russ. That could not be said of, say, A.E. Vanvo.
Right, that's true. Yes, that's true enough. Although
I didn't have to go around toting a bucket on behalf of Russ to get them to.
Well, no. And Chip Delaney's, I think, in the same position. That,
yes, I think so.
People know. No, him. Well, I have to tell this. When I was in graduate school, I sat in on a couple of courses taught by Frederick Jameson, the renowned critic and philosopher who also loved science fiction. And he brought Chip Delaney to campus to talk to the class that Fred was teaching. And Delaney gave a talk to the faculty, to the community in general. And he was up there talking about Roger Zelazny. And it was a moment of satisfaction that I had not felt before, and I have to admit I haven't really felt since, to know that Samuel R. Delaney and Frederick Jameson and I were the only three people in that room who knew who Roger Zelazny was.
Mm-hmm.
But it was ever thus. And it's changing. I mean, that whole thing is changing. I mean, that's another discussion, but I think that that sort of willful obliviousness to what people are doing in genre writing is there. I mean, it's still there, and you know, we, Andy and I, could both talk endlessly about what things we've encountered in the academy. But I think that it's at least in part a generational thing, and I do find more. Nobody has ever blinked at my school about the stuff that I do, my involvement with science.
Well, and if you look at the growth and sustaining presence of ICFA, the conference that all of us tend to go to each March, That speaks to a fairly healthy development in the field, both on the writerly side and the academic side.
Oh, absolutely. And all you have to do is talk to the grad students at ICFA and get a sense of that. And also talk to people who go to that conference who are not coming up from within the subculture. You know, just this wide variety of graduate students, of junior faculty, and it's just all part of it. And I think you get that with younger writers outside the field. I think it really is a struggle. I remember when I met the very fine writer Daniel Wallace. He has one of the contributors to the Crossroads anthology, and he wrote the novel Big Fish. It was the basis for the Tim Burton movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I met him and I talked to him about my interest in science fiction, he immediately said, "Oh, I love Mona Lisa Overdrive." So I think that I'm not sure that I would have gotten a comparable comment out of, say, I can't pull a name out. But of writer, if that conversation had taken place even 20 years earlier, I don't think it would have gone the way that it did. Let's put it that way.
Well, and at ICFA, I want to give a shout out to Andy's other or better half, depending on how you want to put it, Sydney Duncan's done a great job.
There's no doubt. Yes.
But Sydney Duncan's done just a wonderful job. I know. Rachel Sworsky came to ICFA this year, and I'm sure that was partway Sydney's doing, and you know, keeping that the newer people coming in is incredibly important.
It was great to see Rachel there. I haven't gone through combing through Mark Kelly's records to double check, but I am pretty sure that Rachel is the first of my former students to win a Nebula Award.
Ah, congratulations.
She, thanks on her behalf. I can't say I had anything to do with her career, but I was just pleased to be there when it was starting. ICFA is a wonderful such event, the conference on the fantastic in the arts. Sydney does work very hard on getting authors involved, getting authors and critics, academics and practitioners together on panels, keeping the conversation going. The perennial worry, of course, is that some people go and experience the convention only as authors and only to hang out with the authors, and others go and experience the convention only as critics from the academic side and only hang out with the other academics. But that's probably to the good. I mean, you're always going to have that. And if you can have a really successful author conference and a really successful academic conference, and then you have about a third of the people or 25% of the people in the middle enjoying both and talking to the two camps, then that's probably ideal, I suppose.
Yeah, and let me underscore that Sydney has done heroic work with her what she's been doing with the conference. The author tracks and readings are just splendid, and she's just done a marvelous, marvelous job with that, and certainly has been encouraging of the sort of crosstalk that Andy's referring to, of getting the academics to talk with the fiction writers and vice versa, and which can be kind of an issue sometimes. And sometimes it almost reminds me of discussions I've heard talking about that this is really dating me, the fan-pro split that you run into sometimes at conventions. And it's something that I try to be aware of. I think part of it is that whether it's ICFA or World Fantasy or ReaderCon or whatever, that particularly those of us who don't live in major urban areas, that is our chance to see our friends. And
oh,
we
yeah.
naturally gravitate towards our friends, and it's highly likely that our friends are going to be among the people who are doing the same things that we're doing. Andy, I don't know if I've ever asked you this or not, but I just brought up issue of fans and all that sort of subculture stuff. When you first started getting involved professionally, or when you came to it, just what was your awareness of the science fiction subculture of fandom as opposed
to
somebody who was just reading science fiction?
Well, it's a very strange thing. It's a good question to ask. My initial response is almost nil, because when I was one of John Kessel's students at North Carolina State as a graduate student, after 7 years in the newspaper business, I went back to school both to try fiction writing seriously, which I had never done, and to try teaching to see how I liked it. And I went to NC State not only because it was nearby, but because two writers I respected a lot were on the faculty there, Lee Smith and John Kessel. And Kessel was my entree, really, to the convention scene, to Locus, to the magazines, to the Clarions, to the awards, to all the stuff we've been talking about that constitutes, I guess, the traditional genre. But on the other hand, years before that, off and on, I had been aware that this stuff went on. It had just never occurred to me to really become a part of it. I remember StellarCon was a convention in Greensboro for years when I lived in Greensboro. And I remember going there 1 year specifically to hear Fred Pohl talk, because Fred Pohl was one of the guests that year.
I was at that convention.
Probably
you and I met.
Yeah, there were several occasions, Karen, when Brett and I, through the years, we figured out we're in the same room together without actually meeting. But as I recall, I found out on the schedule when Pohl was talking, went over to the hotel, walked in, went to the Pohl talk, and then left. Mm-hmm. So that was the extent of my interest. And before that, Dixie Trek, a predecessor of Dragon Con, a media convention that was held in Atlanta every year. When I was an undergrad and just out of undergrad, I went there several times, a couple of times with my friend Ed Chambliss, just to see, you know, Doctor Who actors and that woman who was on that Star Trek episode.
yeah, that woman.
That was usually the about the extent of my knowledge. But you knew
enough to know that the conventions existed, and you...
I knew that they existed, but it never occurred to me to get particularly involved in them. Mm-hmm. Certainly not to go to any with any consistency. And the only science fiction or fantasy magazine I had any knowledge of in high school was Rod Serling's The Twilight Zone magazine when it started about the late 70s or 1980. Yeah. Because it circulated at the convenience store on the corner where I was accustomed to buying my comic books.
That's right, The Virtues of Slick versus Nigel.
Right, so I don't know that I ever held a copy of Asimov's until I was one of Kessel students. And by then, 74, 84, 94, by that time I was about 30.
Right.
So really I missed out on a lot of that. I was just sort of hitting, glancing acquaintance at it, but it never occurred to me that it was going to be a big part of my life until the Kessel introduction.
Right, right. I think that that's more and more typical, and it's something I've been thinking about recently, because I was active in... As a teenager, I was a teenage science fiction fan. I was active in fanzine fandom back in the 70s and really did come up through that subculture in a kind of classic sense. And I just don't think that I think that that experience is not is seldom there anymore. I think that most writers who come to the field these days, even though it's very easy to pretty quickly learn what with the various online communities, it's very easy to learn very quickly that there are networks of like-minded people out there who have might have interest in you and what you're doing. But I think that coming into it with an being aware that A.E. Van Vogt, but being aware of something like the Van Vogt Knight issues that we were talking about earlier, that that sort of institutional knowledge is not something that is as widespread as it used to be.
Of course, one thing I've noticed is that sometimes those sort of archetypal, those early specific authors, they may not necessarily be known by name or what have you, but they're in the air. People pick up, even if they weren't influenced by Lovecraft or Van Vogt or Stapledon, they're influenced by people who were influenced by them.
Right.
Actually, I had two occasions just recently where I'd read a book and went, oh my god, this is so much like Stapledon, and I was actually able to, in both cases, talk to the authors and say, what Stapledon have you read? And they both said, not much. Right. You know, they were influenced by people who were influenced by Stapledon. It's become a little more, removed, but the influence is still there, obviously.
Right. But I had that experience once when somebody told me that one of my stories reminded her of an H.G. Wells story that it turned out I'd never read. That somebody's cue to say great minds think alike, but...
Well, it's part of the conversation. You know, that's how a conversation evolves through the generations.
Oh, yeah. Well, Karen, I also want to congratulate you on having gone this far without having brought up anything to do with the South.
I've actually been kind of amazed. I've had that in the back of my head if the conversation were to flag, but...
Okay.
Well, it doesn't happen as much anymore, but we got tired for a while of being on the same panel over and over about Southern science fiction.
Right? Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you do the book that we did, and I guess that's kind of inevitable. This is something that Andy and I were just talking at ICFA about with Terry Bisson, who's someone, a great friend to both of us, I dare to say very to us, a kind of role model, and the idea that if there is this interest in, you know, what do we make of Southern science fiction, and I think maybe it is because of a feeling of maybe a lack of precedent for it. I'm stumbling over here. Andy, say something wrong.
Well, people just there, when we started talking about this back in the mid-90s, there was just no body of criticism. And now there is still no body of criticism. people that talk about Southern fiction just don't talk about science fiction. And people that talk about science fiction just don't talk about Southern fiction. Even though there is considerable overlap.
And also, to be a Southern writer, to deal with the question of being a Southern writer is like dealing with the question of being a New Wave writer or a cyberpunk, is that everybody who may qualify is going to deny it on some level, some level or other. I think that anybody who is from the South and is a writer kind of flinches on some level when the issue of, well, are you a Southern writer gets raised. And I know that's something that Terry has talked about as well.
I had to write some... initially, the first two stories that made my name anyway were both deeply Southern pieces. And so were some of the follow-up stories. And I really... became self-conscious about it. I wanted to prove that I wasn't just that Southern guy. And so I wrote some stories that were determinedly not Southern. And so that was all right. And eventually the burden was gone. I guess I reached sort of the level of maturity when I was okay writing about Southern things and not Southern things. But I also remain convinced that my upbringing and where I'm from is stamped in everything I write, in ways that I can tell and the ways that other people could tell that they would be a better judge of than me. But I think our field is full of regionalists. It always has been. The Clifford Simaks and the Ray Bradburys and the so forth. Asimov's Trantor, the planet-sized city, is just an extension of the New York that he grew up in, the Brooklyn, in some way. I mean, that's not all we're doing, of course. I mean, as I always have always said about all labels, they are useful insofar as they are descriptive, and they become useless the moment you start trying to pigeonhole people or prescribe what they need to be writing.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I always remember the encounter when I was in grad school and home visiting in South Carolina and working on a story for class to take to workshop. And I was sitting in the public library at home with the books piled up, and the mother of a friend of mine from high school came by to chat and said, are you working on a project for class? I said, yeah, I'm working on a new short story. And she said, oh, what's it about? And I said, it's about this, the trial of a dead pope in medieval Europe, who was, the pope was like exhumed by his mad successor so that the corpse could be put on trial. And my story is the point of view of the guard that was assigned to guard the papal corpse. And I had not quite learned yet, as I have since, that people really don't want to know what you're writing about. so all that came out just sort of automatically, and she just stared at me, as well she might. But then what she said was, said, no, that's not what you're supposed to write about. She said, you're supposed to write about your hometown and your upbringing and your family. And I said, well, who the hell would want to read that? I said, how boring that would be. So I think she was offended.
Yeah, and well, that it's like I saw recently that somebody said, well, what you were doing, of course, is defying the old homily about write what you know. And, of course, if we only wrote about what we know, then not a whole lot would get written, because, by and large, we don't know all that much. But the trick is to write about what you care about.
You care about, you know things through many routes.
Right.
And your knowledge changes and evolves. You know more as you go along.
Yeah,
of course, on another level there, and that story, after many rejections, got published by Weird Tales. That's in my first collection. But on another level, you look back on that in hindsight, and even though it's set in medieval Italy, medieval Rome, what more Southern Gothic story could you get?
Exactly.
It's like it's a rose for Emily in the Vatican. You know?
Oh, now my head hurts.
The main character is like actually dead.
Mm-hmm.
Just sitting there, sort of moldering,
So
there you go. I didn't quite leave the trappings of my upbringing behind.
And there's also, I think, what you were saying about the regionalism as opposed to any particular region. I think there are some writers who are very regionally informed. And one thing I found with my own stories is that most of what I was writing when I was living in the South were stories set in the South, and since I've moved to New England, most of what I've written are stories set in New England. Now, they're not set right here and now in New England, but they're still they're still set in New England to one degree or another, and so maybe that's just my temperament, is to be very strongly informed with wherever I happen to be. But I also think there's a tendency among science fiction readers and perhaps among science fiction writers that, you know, one of the impetus of the field is to, on some level, maybe try to get away from all that or deny it, that we are all citizens of the galaxy on some level. I remember one of the things that stood out for me. There were many things in Judith Merrill's memoir that her daughter put together that was published a few years ago. There were many things that stood out for me, but the one that stood out the most was this anecdote that she told. And I cannot remember whether Merrill was born in New York and then was in school in Boston or vice versa. But she was born one place and then was in high school in the other place, and she had to get up to give a presentation in class, and the class was ridiculing her accent. And she said she decided then and there that she was going to erase her accent, and so nobody, again, would ever be able to tell where she was from. And I thought that was one of the saddest things I'd ever read. But I think that maybe on some level, to get back to what Andy was saying about a lack of criticism, a lack of precedent, that I think you are kind of pushing upstream if you try to locate science fiction literature within a specific specific region or a specific outlook. I think there's a lot of historical pressure within the field that works against that.
I was told more than once in school when they realized in college when people realized I made A's and was reasonably smart that I was told more than once by professors and advisors and authority figures that of course I would need to work on this accent. Of course I would need to moderate that if I ever wanted to get anywhere. And either I would say nothing, or if I was feeling particularly snotty that day, because this was in the 80s, I would invoke the president pro tempore of the Senate. I would say, oh, is that how Strom Thurmond did it? Yeah. And then they wouldn't say anything. And so all that sort of thing had the opposite effect from what Judith Merrill experienced. It just made me more determined to not change my accent.
Yeah.
And I've become a little jaded in the science fiction field because, frankly, people have got used to me. People know what they're getting when I show up. And I no longer get those delightful bits of electricity like the Worldcon. Was it Baltimore in 97? Was that when I was on the Campbell Best New Writer ballot? I would have to look this up. Have to look up the chronology of your own life.
Oh, yeah.
But that year, I was on the ballot with Richard Garfinkel and Susan Matthews and Mary Doria Russell and other people. And it was a panel with all the nominees, and there we were sitting, and most of the people had never laid eyes on any of us before. And it was a big room. It was very well attended. There were hundreds of people there. And I was sitting at the end of the table, and I think Michael Burstein, God bless him, was moderating. And so he started at the end opposite from me, which is not an unreasonable thing to do. So everybody was introducing themselves and talking about themselves and their work and so forth. And it was all very nice and informal. And it finally marched along to me. And about 20, 25 minutes after we started, it was my turn to talk. And I began to talk, and I will never forget the expressions and the body movements of dozens of people throughout the auditorium. It was almost like doing the wave. As I began to speak, and the grits flew out of my mouth, and I saw all these strangers, just like, it was like cattle prods were being applied. They were jumping visibly and starting and sitting up straight and leaning forward and gaping like, what did he say? Because they were just so unused to hearing a voice, an accent like this at a science fiction convention. And it's still not terribly common. But people are just used to that now. They know, oh, there's Duncan on the program. He's going to come. He's going to do like my classmate as an undergrad did in Alabama when I was making some speech in class to my classmates that I thought was very well-reasoned, and he sat there glaring at me. And as we were all filing out of the classroom, he was loitering in the hallway to jump me when I came out. And I came out, and he came up to me, and he said, "I'm wise to your Southern act."
Exactly the same thing happened to my sister-in-law, who was a native of North Carolina, when she was an undergraduate at Vassar. Someone said to her, "Okay, you can drop the accent." and to this day, well, when I arrived in Vermont, I was fairly exotic goods. It's just people are not used to hearing accents that are not their own. And what you were saying about not hearing it at a science fiction convention, about the only place you would have heard it would have been at a Southern regional convention. There is this
Chattacon or Armadale,
like Chattacon or Deep South Con, wherever it may be.
But even so, that's not how David Drake presents when he opens. David's a lot smarter than I am and better educated than I am. He knows the Latin, to paraphrase Peter Cook. He has the Latin for the Jews.
He
Jews.
Has the Latin. That's
But I, you know where I still hear some of that now? It's when I'm going around to academic conferences that are not science fiction. I go to like things like the Investigative Reporters and Editors conferences because of my journalism hat. Or I go to things like AWP, the Associated Writing Programs, and I still get some of that. But I don't really get it in science fiction anymore. I guess I'm too well known. Of course, I don't exactly see a parade of Southern talking youngsters coming along after me. either. I can't claim to have started any sort of groundswell there.
Well, on that note, we should probably start to look at wrapping things up.
Okay. Oh, my Lord. I'm sorry, I just looked at the clock on my computer. Good heavens. How did that happen?
Exactly. Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah.
So the traditional closing on the Locus Roundtable is to give everyone an opportunity to talk about what they're working on now, or what they might have coming out soon. And Brett?
Okay, sure. I'd be glad to. I am still struggling with, as I made an earlier allusion to, a novel in endless progress, and I have nothing to add to that allusion. Novel, endless progress. There you go. There were two things I did want to mention. One of my stories that was published in the British magazine Black Static, called The Serpent and the Hatchet Gang, is going to be reprinted in an anthology called Creatures, 30 Years of Monster Stories, that is co-edited by Paul Tremblay and John Langan, and is coming out from Prime Books later this year. And I also wanted to mention, not completely for selfish purposes, that there is an e-book that has been compiled called Southern Fried Weirdness Reconstruction, edited by T.J. McIntyre. And this was assembled as a fundraiser for Tornado Relief.
Oh, yes.
And if we ever do this again, Andy and I can tell you about our shared and separate tornadoes.
Absolutely.
We could do a whole tornado podcast.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
That channel would like to.
That's right. That's right. We'll tell you about the tornado we survived in Alabama and how once we knew that we had survived, we started composing the Locus Obituary.
Which
is still in progress. But anyway, this book, Southern Fried Weirdness Reconstruction, it's an e-anthology. It is available through Amazon, and the proceeds from the book are to go to the American Red Cross for tornado relief. And it includes a very early story of mine called Up Above the Deadline that is something that harkens back to my more overtly Southern Gothic days. And and the book also contains one of the stories from our Crossroads anthology, a very fine story by the writer Marion Carcace called The Moon and the Stars. So what? I would certainly urge everybody to go to Amazon or I think it's I want to say WordPress. I think that's where McIntyre's blog is. And just track down Southern Fried Weirdness Reconstruction. You don't even have to read it. Just buy it. And so the money will go to a very worthy cause.
Excellent. And Andy?
Well, my new story titled Slow as a Bullet is the first story in Jonathan's new Eclipse volume from Nightshade. It just came out in May.
It's Eclipse 4, for those of you keeping count.
That's right. Edited by Jonathan, Strahan, from Nightshade. And new collection coming out this fall from PS Publishing, titled The Pottawatomie Giant and Other Stories. And it includes a new novelette titled Close Encounters, which is about UFOs in Arkansas. And what else? I'm doing a reading at the KGB bar in Greenwich Village on September 21. Me and Michael Swanwick. So everybody should come out for that.
Excellent. Well, thank you both very much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for inviting us. This was great.